This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
And unlike many of the speakers here today, I do require an introduction. I work with the Mountford Collection at the State Library of South Australia. And a bit like Mountford, I perhaps might be unqualified to speak here today, but I do know, I don't necessarily know everything about Mountford, and I'm learning so much about this expedition today and yesterday, but I do know something of the collection that I work with, and I hope to show you as much as I can today. I've got a lot of slides, just to bring a little bit of the Mountford collection to you today. Here's the man, Charles P. Mountford, leader of the American-Australian Scientific Expedition to Arnhem Land, as we know. The Mountfordshire collection of the State Library of South Australia holds the wealth of material gathered by Mountford throughout his career. And it was actually the Arnhem Land Expedition that was the catalyst for its organisation and donation. Mountford was exhausted upon his return from Arnhem Land, and to recover he went to stay with his friend Harold Sheard, who lived in the coastal town of Port Elliot in South Australia. During this stay, Sheard noticed that Mountford was sorting through his Arnhem Land work and became worried when he saw Mountford discarding things that may hold future value. So Sheard began a project to assemble Mountford's private archive from this expedition and his others, and sought a suitable repository. With the encouragement of South Australia's state librarian Hedley Brideson, the bulk of the collection was donated to the State Library in 1957. And according to a 1998 interview with Brideson, the two were acquainted. I think Brideson asked Mountford to speak at a Sunday school class, and they'd crossed paths at various functions. After that, in time they came to discuss Sheard's growing collection of Mountford material, Mountford joking at one point that Sheard was soon going to be sleeping out on his lawn and that he just couldn't cope with it anymore. To this, Brideson responded, "All right then, let us have it. We'll find somewhere to put it." A bibliography was prepared by Sheard and that accompanied the collection in 1958, and Mountford requested that the collection be named Mountford Sheard to reflect his friend's substantial contribution. More material was donated in following years. Now, whilst the South Australian Museum may have seemed a more logical home for Mountford's work, it is likely that the frosty relations between Mountford and Museum Director Norman Tyndale, to be expanded upon below, made this impossible. And according to Brideson, if Mountford had taken the collection to Tyndale, his response would have been, "Throw the bloody lot out." As detailed already, the idea for the Arnhem Land Expedition came in 1945 when Mountford was on a lecture tour of the United States. During this tour, Mountford recorded an extraordinary 4,000 pages in his personal journal, and he predicted big things from the trip. On New Year's Day 1945, he wrote, "I don't suppose I've started any year with greater possibilities." During the lecture tour, Mountford gave over 50 presentations to an estimated total audience of about 50,000, including the pivotal presentation to the National Geographic Society at Constitution Hall in Washington, D.C. And it's apparent from Mountford's journal that this was a big coup for him. Despite an awkward moment when the film broke during the screenings, Mountford felt afterwards that he had made the grade. Dr. Alexander Wetmore, chief of the Smithsonian, congratulated him after the show, and that night Mountford wrote in his journal, "I don't think I need to bother about Tyndale's innuendos from now on." This is one of the frequent references Mountford makes to a career-long professional rivalry between the two men. Their working relationship began in 1925, I believe, when they co-authored a paper about those rock engravings that Dr. Jones showed us. And by 1945, the two would have encountered each other innumerable times, including whilst Mountford was an honorary assistant in ethnology at the SA Museum and during a 1935 field trip to the Warburton Ranges. And this is a photo that we saw earlier today. In a field deeply divided between professionals and amateurs, Tyndale and others, Elkin and the Burnts have already been mentioned, regarded Mountford as insufficiently trained to have his scientific work taken seriously, and it is most likely this attitude that was expressed in Tyndale's innuendos. Mountford struggled against this perceived inferiority throughout his career, and it troubled him to the end of his life. Tyndale was stationed at the Pentagon at the time of Mountford's lecture tour to the United States and was invited to attend a presentation given on January the 20th at the Department of the Interior. His presence unsettled Mountford a little, who recorded, "I was sure that Tyndale would get up and give a sub-lecture, but curiously enough, he kept quiet." A few weeks later, following a lecture at Washington's Cosmos Club, the secretary of the National Geographic Society suggested Mountford approach the society for a grant to carry out more research. Arnhem Land was chosen, and Mountford received agreement from the society while still in the US. A second lecture tour in 1946 was used to further plan the expedition. Once back in Australia, plans progressed rapidly for a departure in March 1947, but the expedition was postponed, as we've heard, finally getting underway in March 1948. A high-profile event, correspondence files hold evidence of the many and varied engagements the party took part in before their departure for Darwin. As well as official functions with mayors, consuls and governors, the party was the subject of much interest within the scientific and intellectual communities, who hosted a plethora of receptions, lectures, lunches and screenings. I noted also that one article describes a trip to the Barossa Valley by a few of the party to inspect wineries at Angaston and Seppeltsfield. I'm sure it was all very scientific. Once the expedition was underway, Mountford began a personal journal. Recurrent themes of his writings include his leadership responsibilities, logistical issues, illness and personality conflicts. Mountford also writes about the landscape and weather conditions and recorded his interactions with Aboriginal informants and missionaries. There were 47 tonnes of gear to transport to and around Arnhem Land, and this more than any other issue haunted Mountford's arrangement and execution of the expedition, as we've heard today. It led him to undertake tasks which were clearly beyond his health, as he felt only he had the influence to do so, or perhaps he did so to prove his capabilities as leader. For instance, when the Phoenix failed to arrive on Groote Island and radio communication had failed, Mountford, along with Fred Rose, Gordon Sweeney and a group of Aboriginal men, I'm told this may have included Gerald Blitner, made a treacherous 38-mile trek to the Angaroogoo River Mission Station to use their radio and attempt contact. Mountford was 58 at this time and expressed frequently in his journal how health issues were affecting him. During the journey to Angaroogoo, he described himself as long past the Boy Scout stage, and he wrote, "I would never have contemplated such a journey from choice, but the food situation is getting serious, the telephone does not work, and no one but myself would be in the position to make the decisions. So there was nothing else to do but go. I was not happy about the matter." Waist-deep swamps extended for miles, and before reaching the mission, Mountford was nearly swept away when he fell into a fast-running stream, only to grab onto a tree branch and be rescued by some Aboriginal boys, no doubt more accustomed to that environment. And after an equally fraught trip to retrieve the Phoenix and its cargo, the barge finally reached their camp on the 24th of May, 5 weeks after her scheduled arrival. As we've heard, the party worked from Groote Island and surrounds until about the 8th of July, 7 weeks later than anticipated due to the late arrival of the Phoenix. Mountford believed this was advantageous as it offered greater opportunity for study. However, the delay did require the abandonment of the Roper River camp. The next campsite was to be located near the Yirrkala Mission, and there was some disagreement in the party about the proposed location. I believe McCarthy and Setzler preferred the old Gove Station, a distance from the mission settlement, but Mountford preferred closer to the mission itself. And so on the 20th of June, he begrudgingly took a flight to the Gove airstrip to conduct a reconnoitre. The day before, he had written, "It seems fated that whenever I have to go anywhere where only I can make decisions, I fall ill with some ailment. Tonsillitis on the Phoenix trip, lumbago on Bickerton, and now dysentery," which I believe had been going around the camp. On the day, he wrote, "I was very weak this morning, but decided to go to Yirrkala to make the decision after seeing both camps. I had previously decided on the beach at Yirrkala. It looked a good camp to me, but thought it only fair to inspect Gove." And I've circled there the line, "especially after the politics of Setzler." And he often makes these notes, and they appear in a different ink. So I don't know if he wrote them the next day or 5 years later. I'd be fascinated to know. But the inspection did little to change his original decision to base the camp near the mission, as he described the Gove Station as in a ramshackle state, and was concerned about its distance from fresh water. The whole exercise was really difficult for Mountford, who recorded that he was suffering greatly at the time. "The journey in the jeep was very trying," he says. "I was weak and the jolting brought on abdominal cramps. I was pleased to again climb into my bed on my return to Umbacumba." But Mountford did not record details of the Yirrkala camp in his journal. In fact, after the move, the first and only entry in his personal journal was made weeks after their arrival on the 28th of July. "For a whole month I have not had time to write in my diary," he says, and goes on to record a short summary of the trip from Groot Island, saying, "We reached Yirrkala on the 8th and... dot, dot, dot." It is surprising to note that, to our knowledge, this was the final entry Mountford made in his personal journal. Whilst nothing has been found to directly explain this, it seems more than coincidental that this change in habit occurred around the time of the leadership discussion of the 10th of July. Having been told to concentrate on filmmaking, photography and administrative matters, Mountford most likely felt under pressure to squeeze the most out of every day. The role of leadership, therefore, may have left no time for personal writings. Moreover, the desire to continue with his scientific investigations into artwork, despite being told not to, would have taken precedence over recording a personal journal. In his Yirrkala fieldwork journal, he writes with barely concealed frustration, "I will not have time to gather the interpretation of more than a few paintings from this locality because of other duties." And so, without his narrative, we must now turn to the contents of the collection to tell the story of Mountford's work. Here's a small sample of his photography from the expedition. Mountford was a keen and talented photographer with an artistic eye, apparently only of still subjects, as Philip said. And whilst much ethnographic photography up to that time focused on people as objects, Mountford's style produced an image with both ethnographic and aesthetic appeal. The Mountford Sheard collection contains almost 2,500 photographs taken during the Arnhem Land expedition. As well as the people and the landscapes, Mountford photographed and described artworks in each of the three locations and their vicinities. The collection contains two large volumes of the analysis of Groot Island artworks, and one also contains typescripts of associated songs and their meaning that he recorded. The library holds not a lot, just approximately 50 minutes of original recordings relating to Groot Island, Deliciville and Oompelli. Mountford's fieldwork from Yirrkala consists of almost 176 pages of notes, photographs and drawings of bark paintings, woven, decorated and painted objects and rubbings of engraved objects. And I thank Margot for giving us a wonderful description of this one. I won't go into it. As in each of his fieldwork journals, artworks are illustrated with a small photograph, and next to this Mountford drew his own version with descriptions and annotations pointing out the important aspects of the design and its associated story. During the expedition's third and final camp at Oompelli, Mountford spent the majority of his time documenting the widespread rock art of the area, mostly around Inulac and Argilac, with brief sojourns to Innagirdable, Cannon Hill and Oberey. Four large volumes in the Mountford Sheard collection contain highlights of the pictures Mountford took of galleries in Western Arnhem Land. Each figure is assigned a unique number, and there is a record of its location and size, plus a visual description. There is a photograph and or a sketch of the figure, but generally little or no ethnographic interpretation. Mountford was advised of the best spots to see such artwork by a past Oompelli missionary, Alf Dyer. Dyer corresponded with Mountford before the expedition's departure, describing and illustrating where he had and had not seen paintings across Arnhem Land. And this is an example of, he drew two maps, one of Western and one of Northeast Arnhem Land. And perhaps it is in the correspondence and administration files of the expedition that much of Mountford's labours can be best appreciated. I've just got a couple of examples of some letters here. I'm not sure how well you can read them. I've got printouts of all of these if people want to ask me about them later. It's quite remarkable to look through the correspondence and to consider all of the facets of the expedition that Mountford had to occupy him. You know, letters about not filling in the right paperwork might have seemed a bit insignificant compared to some of the problems he was dealing with. Evident in the correspondence files is the conflict that arose between Mountford and the administrative staff of the CMS missions of Groot Island and Oompelli, and there is a continual stream of correspondence between the missions and Mountford debating the payment of accounts and the compensation given for the use of Aboriginal labour. The final resolution of these matters came over a year after the completion of the expedition, with the Department of Information finally settling all payments. Mountford had kept comprehensive records of all transactions to satisfy his own needs as well as those of the budget-conscious department. He was a meticulous and stubborn person, and he could never bring himself to agree with the mission's tally. Another dispute captured in the correspondence files was the accusation that Mountford was hoarding exhibition material upon their return. A letter from 1949 from Dr. Clements of the Institute of Anatomy to Kevin Murphy of the Department of Information alleges that Mr. Mountford has retained considerably more than one third of the material collected and that it is at present in his private possession in his home in Adelaide. A long list of items follows. Mountford has annotated the letter, stimulated by McCarthy, and then in a different ink, a stinker. Sorry, I don't think Martin McCarthy's here today. At the close of the letter, Mountford has written, "McCarthy overplayed his hand. Am allowed to keep material as long as I wish. Was not stored at home, but in South Australian Museum." And I'm sure that the distribution of this artwork will be discussed even more over the next few days. Another important event illustrated by the correspondence is the attempt to oust Mountford from his position as leader soon after the party's arrival at Yirrkala. And without his own diarised accounts, it is only through correspondence and Bessie's journals that we are able to gain an insight into his perspective. According to a letter Mountford sent Wetmore at the Smithsonian 2 weeks after the incident, I think he started drafting it the day after it happened, but, you know, after something happens and you cross about it, you're supposed to breathe and think about it, and he did that and sent the letter 2 weeks later. He said, "The visiting officials had accused me of mismanagement, made insulting remarks about my status as a scientist, and forbade me to carry out research work. Mr. Murphy then offered the control of the scientific personnel to Mr. Setzler. To my surprise, Setzler did not refuse the position." When Bessie asked her husband what the meeting was about, he gravely replied, "I have been demoted as leader. Frank is to take my place." In her own journal, Bessie adds that it seemed that Murphy was anxious for film and thought to secure more of Monty's work in filmmaking by demanding that Monty leave all research to the professionals. He emphasised that Monty was a film director, not a scientist, and was very rude in his emphasis. News of this spread slowly at first, but then Bessie writes that when told, ornithologist Bert Dagnan was shamed to sickness by the actions of his colleague and vowed to sort it out. That's her description. The next day, the American scientists met, and Bessie believes it was their influence that led to Setzler belatedly refusing the leadership offer, and as other sources say, that is the case. Bessie writes, "Never have I seen a man so utterly defeated as Frank S. He later confessed to Monty that never in his life had he been given such a drubbing that he had never realised just how awful a thing he had done." Tensions eased in the following days, and Bessie believed that some good may have come from the event, both in firming up loyalty for Mountford and in helping him face some of his shortcomings. She noted that he had begun to adopt a less rigid manner in matters of control. As just illustrated, the diaries of Bessie Mountford provide a valuable counterpoint to the contents of the Mountford Sheard collection. So before I conclude, I would like to touch on their contents briefly. Mountford had married Bessie, or Johnny, as Mountford called her after her maiden name Johnston, in 1933, 8 years after the death of his first wife, Florence. Throughout their marriage, Bessie had an active political career, advocating for women's rights and political representation through organisations such as the League of Women Voters. This organisation promoted equal rights in marriage, divorce and work, and Bessie gave conference papers and wrote essays for the cause. She also ran as an independent candidate in the 1938 and 1941 South Australian state elections. In 1948, Bessie acted as Honorary Secretary to the Arnhem Land Expedition. In addition to these considerable duties, she also assisted Mountford, Setzler and Walker in various tasks. Journalist Colin Simpson, who joined the expedition for a while in Owen Pelly, wrote of Bessie, "She showed no chagrin at being left behind when others went off to arduous, exciting places. She accepted discomfort and asked no favours. She never took rank to herself as the leader's wife, but she was always and admirably the wife of the leader." Bessie often drafted expedition correspondence, and I'm not sure whether this was written by her and then edited by Mountford or dictated by Mountford, typed by her. I think there was probably a combination of the two, but much of the correspondence that we hold is typed. The draft correspondence is typed, yet there are handwritten annotations by Mountford. As an example, this text appeared in a letter drafted in early July. It says, "The morale of the camp is high. No personal differences have developed and all are anxious to continue in the work you and your society have made possible." And Mountford has written and then crossed out, "Serious?" Okay. You can see it. He's written it and scrubbed it out there. In her diary, Bessie describes her and Mountford's daily experiences and reflects on interactions between expedition members. Her notes reveal her as observant, opinionated, intelligent, and compassionate. When time permitted, Bessie set out to interact with Aboriginal people, mostly the women. And when she first encounters the Aboriginal people of Umbakumba, she writes, "Like all native people I have met, they are quick to laugh." But she faced some obstacles, both because of the shy nature she observed in them and language difficulties. "I tried to talk to some of the native women this morning, but they do not speak my tongue." At Yirrkala, Bessie writes about teaching two Aboriginal women to crochet, and I'll just read a little passage from her diary here. "During the afternoon, Bangara and Bali called and stayed, enjoying themselves for a couple of hours. I was crocheting when they arrived, and they were too keen on learning to crochet to be interested in their native tales and customs," which obviously Bessie wanted to hear about. "Bali was quick on the uptake, and her fingers were nimble. She immediately grasped the way of holding both needle and cotton, keeping the tension of the thread fairly uniform. But with Bangara, it was another matter entirely." Upon the party's departure from Umbakumba, she reflected on the effect that this would have on Marjorie Gray, who we saw earlier as the wife of Fred Gray. She writes, "My heart ached for her. Ever since she reached Groot Island, the thought of the people of the expedition staying with them has been a beacon towards which she has carried on. Someone was coming. Now it was no wonder she cried when I bade her farewell, and it took me all of my self-control not to sit down and weep with her." As previously alluded to, Bessie's diaries also contain an insightful account of the attempt to depose Mountford at Yirrkala, and it must have been very difficult for her to separate the dual roles of secretary and wife. But in her diary, we are able to observe Bessie's love and support for Mountford, despite separate tents. Following the attempt to oust him in Yirrkala, she writes, "Of course I was quick to protect and, if possible, comfort, encouraging the poor hurt creature to talk and ease himself. Whatever I have been curtailed by in the way of heat and insect pests were as nothing for the fact that I could be so near Monty at so critical an hour." In addition to her Arnhem Land diaries, material donated to the State Library by Bessie also includes a diary she kept on Mountford's 1940 expedition to Central Australia. Harking back to that 1940 expedition, after the series of logistical problems in Arnhem Land, Bessie mused, "The running of such a large undertaking was out and beyond Monty's experience and has involved problems he did not anticipate. Two in Central Australia on camels is not 16 in Arnhem Land." Indeed, on examining the records of the expedition, one has to appreciate the enormity of the task taken on by Mountford, for whilst personally his primary interests may have lain with the ethnography, filmmaking and photography he would be undertaking, the role of leader meant that he needed to be on top of every aspect of the expedition, from making the transport arrangements, organising wages and supplies, as well as reporting to his employers, not to mention managing a group of diverse and strong-willed individuals. And the last slide is just my plug. The Mountford Sheard Collection is a historically significant and valuable record of anthropological fieldwork of that era that holds obvious cultural significance to the Aboriginal communities of Arnhem Land. And whilst Mountford's detractors questioned his credibility as a scientist, as a bona fide anthropologist, it is now acknowledged that much of his work, including that on the Arnhem Land expedition, contributed to the popularisation of Aboriginal art both in Australia and overseas. Aboriginal communities, scholars and authors continue to seek access to the Mountford Sheard Collection, poring over old ground or finding new threads to spin out. And so, whilst there may still be questions concerning Mountford's methods or his manner, there can be no disputing the continuing legacy of the collection that he entrusted to the State Library of South Australia. Thank you.
If you will just stay there.
I will.
We will be having a general discussion in a minute, but before we do that, are there questions specifically to this paper?
Andrew Bray.
Hi, Andrew.
I'm wondering, Susie, if you can go back a couple of slides. I don't know whether I imagined it, but I thought I saw in one of the letters mention of my father's name. The slide I'm talking about was the one before the stinker slide.
Oh, yes.
Also, I was wondering about that, almost the last slide, labelled Johnny's Tent. I wondered who Johnny was.
Oh, Johnny, I did say earlier that Johnny was the name that Mountford had for Bessie. It was her nickname.
Oh, I see. Right.
Her,
okay,
her maiden name was Johnston.
Right, okay.
I think the slide involving your dad is probably...
It was one where there was a criticism about the holding the collection at home. Yes, I think yes. At the very bottom of that, I can't read it from here.
Yes.
But on the right, on well, to my right, your left, I suppose it is.
That's all right, I've got...
At the very bottom, there's a footnote there. Can you read that footnote? In fact, I think it's referring to, looked like grey, actually. Is it Bray or Grey?
Oh, it's Grey from Umbercumber. That's
right.
Part of the disagreement he was having with
I wondered if you could just read out what that says.
I have just noticed that Grey has charged for 7 days... 7 day week throughout the whole of the period of the stay of the expedition. This is incorrect. The Aborigines worked a 6 day week.
Right. it's quite
a stickler.
Quite interesting because... in the diary that I gave to Rowena a little while ago, my father goes on at some length about the payments to Aboriginals in terms of tobacco, and he considered, it was a criticism of Mountford, he considered that the payment for work done around the camp and things like that was really quite inadequate, even by the standards of the time. Mm. And because my father was the cook... in charge of stores and so on, the food suppliers, they frequently had disagreements about the provisions and also about the use of Aboriginal labour around the camp.
Yeah, Mountford was involved in discussions with the Department of Information, the missionaries, the administrators of the Northern Territory, and he was getting different advice and requirements from each, so he was... He was being pushed from pillar to post about it, and he probably, well, he usually thought that he'd done the right thing, but certainly there was disagreement about that amongst many parties.
Well, one of the things that he was particularly annoyed about, my father that is, was that he'd had a disagreement with Mountford at the beginning of the expedition about what should be loaded onto the Catalina flying boats and what should come by barge.
Yeah.
And my father was concerned that they weren't taking enough food on their flying boats and that the barge could, in fact, be lost, as it subsequently almost was. And then my father was left in the position of how would he feed 17 or 18 people on the camp with very little food. And one of the ways he apparently solved that problem was to collect quite a lot of native food, fish particularly and things like that. And that was how he came to be the honorary entomologist, because he... ended up going on morning walks with most of the Aboriginal women and collecting insects and fish and so on at the same time.
Well, there's also a letter from, I think, Montgomery of the Church Missionary Society before they leave, suggesting that they have two barges in case one of them fails, but I don't believe budget allowed that, and Mountford made the decision to stick with one, much to his own detriment.
Hello, Linda Barwick. I just have a question about the photographic documentation. I wonder if you could just tell me a little bit about how well documented that is and how well tied in it is with the rest of the records.
There are what we call contact prints for the black and white photos, so a small card with a small printout of the positive, and we have Mountford's handwritten description on that. His description varies. It will usually include the place name and a brief description. It doesn't often include people's names. Then you go to the journals, and he won't have cross-referenced, oh, this is, you know, picture number 24 or whatever. So there's a lot of difficulty in cross-referencing things, and I know that we have... slides of bark paintings, hundreds of slides of bark paintings. We might even have slides of all of the bark paintings that were taken back to Australia, kept in Australia. But without the proper reference and without getting everyone together, it's difficult to know. So it would be great if somebody could start that kind of project to really get on top of what's where. Yes.
As far as I can recall, that Bessie Mountford was only co-opted onto the expedition at the last moment to act as a chaperone for Margaret MacArthur. Now, she was the wonderful acquisition to the expedition, supporting her husband and doing all the secretarial work, entrepreneurial between the other members of the expedition. And in the last camp at Oanpele, Banyanga, she, every, I was never, I was so busy working, collecting plants and mapping the vegetation, etc., etc., that my work, I was never available for a photograph of me in any of the National Geographic, but that's irrelevant. What I was going to say, that after the evening meal, I'd spend 4 or 5 hours changing plants, the papers and such forth. Yes. And Bessie came in and looked after me and helped me all through that time when she could have been. And now, at the end of it, Mountford said, could you, Charles Monty, could you name a plant after Bessie?
Yes.
And I named Acacia Mount 4DI, and being a Latin scholar, AE was the logical thing. Now, the botanists say it can't be named after Mrs. Mountford, it must be named after Monty.
Of course.
And some of them have changed it to II instead of IAE, but it's a correct.
Well, thank you,
Mount,
that's wonderful.
Bessie was. And she helped me, and Monty helped me from the time of the expedition to get the material out, and I helped with the volume 3 and 4, the zoology and such forth, right up to 1964.
Thank you so much.
Now, I think I should have done this before. We're supposed to go and sit over there. The paper givers since lunch will... Just now, just for the moment, for a few minutes. While the three, we'll all move over here. Before... Well, I'm going to take boss's privilege. I did know Monty, and I just wish to say a few words, partly tribute to him. I came back from Cambridge in 1953 wanting to do some excavation. I had no funds, I had no job. But anyway, the fact is, early in 1955, when I was a lecturer in history at Melbourne, a colleague told me that Monty was visiting Melbourne to give a talk to the Bread and Cheese Club, and I arranged to meet him and told him I was keen on archaeology, and he said, I've just got the right place for you on the Murray River north of Manham, where he'd been associated with a dig a few years earlier. And he said, if you come across to Adelaide, you can stay with me and I'll take you out there. So in the May vacation in 1955, I went over to Adelaide and he took me out to the site. And as soon as I saw it, I said, this will do. This was a site called Fromm's Landing, which was the first excavation where I worked, and we got radiocarbon datings back to 5,000 years. So I'm just greatly indebted to him for starting my career. In addition, Melbourne University Press was publishing the 4 volumes, and he was quite a frequent visitor to Melbourne with discussions of the press, particularly with his book on art, myth and symbolism. He took tremendous trouble over the over that work, I was able to visit him in his sick bed some weeks before he died. But there was one other discovery which he made that nobody has referred to at all. I'm referring to it in the person's absence. Robert Edwards was not able to attend this meeting, but Monty discovered Bob Edwards, who is well known, I'm sure, to many people working in this field. Like myself, we've used his photographs to illustrate countless things. Robert Edwards is a winemaker, actually, and as a young lad, he met Monty, and Monty used to take him out in the field. They have joint publications on rock art recording in South Australia, and I don't know, I'm speaking in total ignorance of this, but I suspect that a great deal of Bob Edwards' knowledge of photography was passed on to him by Mountford. When I was excavating at Fromm's Landing, we were within sight of a tree which Monty had photographed for a book. He's got a whole book on trees in South Australia, and one of them was right at the Fromm's Landing site. Anyway, I think that a great deal of the interest of Robert Edwards, totally as an amateur young lad, and then as he grew up, he was appointed to the South Australian Museum as a curator, and he suffered exactly the same as Monty. He was said not to be a professional. This does raise questions which might well be discussed in the next section, the session that Margot's having. What is the difference between an amateur and a professional, which seems to have been so serious in South Australia during the period from the 30s to the 60s? It divided the world. And so, well, with those comments, I'll now throw it open again for comments and questions to any of the three speakers. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Sarah Bunn from the Art Gallery of New South Wales. Following on from Linda and Susie's comment there about piecing bits together, I've got with me for the conference a colour printout of all works on paper that were collected that we know of, at least over 100 of them, if anybody's interested in seeing them, but also a request for information if you see any printed. I'm building up an archive or collection of anything of the works, bulletin articles from 63. I've got quite a few things with me as well, but if people find anything, please send it my way. And also putting out there is if anyone's interested in doing the same with the works, the Barks, the actual Bark paintings, because there's a lot of them, and the same kind of information is spread all over the place and photographed somewhere, and if somebody's interested, then please come forward.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.